against Africans. At 11 on Between the Covers, Portland writer Rob Yardumian discusses his debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water, and the accompanying music CD, Sing With Me, Brother, For We Have Sinned. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the topic is independent booksellers with guest Michael Hicks of Black Rose Books and Phyllis Benton of Midnight Ramble Films and host Obie Hill of Reflections Mirror Image Books. But first, Teresa Mitchell is still on vacation, so we'll have a special one-hour version of Fight the Empire with host Per Fogering. Today he speaks with Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute, on the geopolitics of food scarcity. And that is coming up next on KBOO.
45 DJs play
45 RPM records
all day.
Tune into KBOO on November 16th from noon to midnight
for a special 45th anniversary celebration.
DJs will play 15-minute sets of 45 RPM records,
while from noon to 8 p.m. we'll have an open house birthday party at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue with refreshments,
birthday cake, station tours, and more.
So join us November 16th
in person at KBOO from noon to 8 p.m. and on air from noon to midnight
to celebrate our 45th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45rpm2013.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. It's a special hour-long show. Teresa Mitchell is on vacation, so we're taking the 9 to 10 slot. And we have a really special guest today. It's Lester Brown, who is the founder of World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute. And he's got a new book out called Breaking New Ground, which is a personal history, and he's also going to be speaking next week, next Tuesday. He will be speaking at the World Affairs Council at 7 p.m. That's Tuesday, November 12th at 7 p.m. And the World Affairs Council is at 1200 Southwest Park. So anyway, that's you get a chance to hear him twice. So anyway, Lester Brown, are you there?
I am here.
Well, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. Are we ready to go?
We are ready to go. Yes.
Do you have an easy question to start with?
Yeah, I do. I think we'll start out with what was it like growing up on a farm in New Jersey?
Well, as I look back now, I realize that growing up on a farm is sort of an education in itself. If you grow up on a farm, you also go to school, but you learn a lot in farming. And then not only did I grow up on a general farm, which meant we had, you know, cows and pigs and chickens, and also grew some cash crops like tomatoes and peppers and so forth, but it was you just have to learn a lot. And then particularly when my younger brother and I, when I was 17, he was 14, started our own farming operation, growing tomatoes for Campbell's Soup. And we became early on one of the larger tomato producers in New Jersey. But that was an extraordinarily educational experience. And I just wish more young people had a chance to grow up on farms and have the opportunity to learn as one does when you're born on and grow up on a farm.
Well, supposedly that kind of family farm is on the way out. It's, you know, it's just the big mega farms that are the thing these days. That's what they say. I don't quite believe it myself. What do you say?
Well, there are different trends. There are, farms have gotten huge today. They've multiplied in size from what they were when I was growing up on a farm 60 years ago. But there's also another interesting trend in agriculture, and that is the development of small farmers who produce for local farmers' markets. And I think in this country, we now have something like 8,000 farmers' markets. And this is, the sales are pretty small compared with supermarket chains, but they do provide fresh, particularly fresh vegetables, fresh fruit as well, but the emphasis on producing fresh vegetables for local markets. And this gives people a chance to get really fresh produce and to know what it's like. If you only buy in a supermarket, you never really know what fresh is. So that's one of the things that farmers markets bring. They bring fresh food and usually high-quality food.
Well, I know then they have urban farms. I mean, I think about 10 or 15 years ago, I remember reading about there was a woman on the west side of town who had, she had about an acre and a half or 2 acres, and she actually raised vegetables and herbs and things for restaurants, and she got so she was able to quit her daytime job.
Well, an acre and a half or 2 acres is actually quite a bit of land if you devote it to intensive vegetable production. Because vegetables mature fairly quickly, most of them you can work in 2 or 3 crops in a year, sometimes even more by interplanting and so forth. So I'm not surprised that she can make a living on 2 acres because restaurants and will pay well. We'll pay a good price for really fresh vegetables.
Yeah, I really like that chapter about you and your brother growing those tomatoes. How many acres did you have to grow all those tomatoes?
Well, we farmed from 1961 to 68. The first year we had 7 acres of tomatoes, which means 28,000 tomato plants, about 4,000 plants per acre. And then the last year I farmed, which was 1958, we had 70 acres or 280,000 tomato plants. So it was a good-sized commercial operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like what you said about just loving the fresh tomatoes right there in the garden. I had a few in my backyard. Portland's not the best place for growing tomatoes.
Excuse me?
I said Portland is not the best place for growing tomatoes, but I had a pretty decent crop. A lot of green tomatoes. They ripen them in the kitchen or make green tomato sauce at them or fry them up or whatever. But It's just there's nothing like going out on a nice hot day and picking a few tomatoes right off the vine, you know?
Yep.
So then you...
And,
go ahead.
And I was just going to say, just for me, the smell of the tomato plant... I can't resist if I'm around someone's house and I have 2 or 3 tomato plants, as is often the case in the backyard. I can't resist sort of burying my head in the tomato vines and smelling them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, even when all the tomatoes are picked and you're chopping up the vines to chop them into the soil, they still got that smell.
Yep.
Well, then you went to Rutgers, the agricultural science. Tell us about that.
Well, as someone who wanted to be a farmer and grow tomatoes for the rest of my life, the obvious thing to do was to go to Rutgers, which is the State University of New Jersey, the College of Agriculture, and get a degree in agricultural science. So during the 4 years at Rutgers, I took 24 science courses in 19 fields. So you can see I was really spread out. And it was courses like entomology, geology, plant pathology, meteorology, soil physics, just a fascinating array of courses. And so I, being able to take 24 courses in 19 fields really gave me a broad sort of acquaintance with issues. Taking just one course in the field doesn't make you the world's leading expert, but it does give you a sense of the basic principles involved in that field. You learn the vocabulary so you can talk about the subject. So for me, planning to be a farmer, taking these science courses was just, I mean, I was a little bit like a kid in a candy store trying to select as many as I could.
Well, then you might be a tomato farmer today if you hadn't gone to India. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, let me tell you one more thing about Rutgers before we switch to India. It's not particularly well known, but the soil science department at the College of Agriculture at Rutgers discovered in the period 1938 to 40 or so many of the antibiotics that we use today, oreomycin, streptomycin, neomycin, you can go down the list. Almost all of these were discovered in the College of Agriculture, in the Soil Science Department, and went into commercial production. For there's a period, I think it's 17 years of royalties that you get on a newly patented, in this case, drug. And that was provided a huge cash inflow for Rutgers University during this period. And more interestingly and importantly, discovery of these antibiotics, I think up until then the only one we had was penicillin maybe, the discovery of these antibiotics revolutionized world medicine. And it's interesting to me that the principal advances in antibiotics did not come in, you know, the National Institute of Health or some health research institute or some commercial company's research operation, some drug company's research. It came from the soil science department at Rutgers, and I've always taken some pride in that.
Well, one thing you said in your book that stuck with me is that in those days there was really no such thing as environmental sciences. In agricultural science, that was it.
Yeah, that was probably, though, I mean, this was before, when I was in school well before Rachel Carson's book of Silent Spring in 1962, which is, I think more than anything else, sort of launched the modern environmental movement. But in retrospect, since there were not environmental science courses being taught in the early 50s when I was in college, taking agricultural science courses was probably as close as you could get. And so it wasn't difficult at all for me to sort of transition from working on agricultural issues to working on environmental issues.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever run across a book called Topsoil and Civilization?
Yes. Trying to remember the author's name.
One, his name was Carter. And I think the other author was Dale or something, but I'm not sure.
And it's an interesting book and approach, sort of emphasizing the fact that civilization rests on roughly a 6-inch layer of topsoil that we find around the world. Occasionally, you can find topsoil deeper than 6 or 7 inches, but mostly it's that thin layer of topsoil that that supports agriculture and indeed most of the plant life on the planet.
Well, the thing that interested me about I first heard about that book, I think I read about it in Mother Earth News way back when, and these authors, they were soil scientists, I think from the University of Indiana, but I'm not sure, and they traced different civilizations, like they started out with Mesopotamia and how they, they exhausted their soil and messed up their canal, so civilization kind of, they went down, and then civilization moved west, and it went through, Lebanon, and then into Greece and Rome, and then Western, and they sort of traced the centers of civilization from Mesopotamia all the way to the New World, and based on what they did with their soil and deforesting and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, agriculture and civilization pretty much expanded together. We have to remember that before agriculture, we were hunter-gatherers, and we really couldn't settle down very well as hunter-gatherers, because when the game was gone in the area where the settlement was, you had to move. So there were not the sort of permanent settlements. It was not until agriculture came in the Mideast that we began to see permanent settlements, and then eventually cities and the emergence of civilization as we know it today. Because before agriculture, we were just hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. And we didn't accumulate very much, you know, culturally or economically. We were sort of always on the move and sort of living from one hunt to the next.
Well, this is Fight the Empire, and my guest is Lester Brown, who is the founder of World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute, and he has a new book out, Breaking New Ground, sort of personal history, and then he's going to be speaking next Tuesday at the World Affairs Council. And I think the topic there is a new geopolitics of food scarcity. But let's talk about India. You went to India sort of kind of like a lucky break.
Yeah, as the year after I graduated from Rutgers, I was selected by the National 4-H Club Foundation as one of several young American farmers to go to India and live in villages there. So that was an interesting experience, interesting in so many ways. Just traveling there was interesting because in 1956, it was the last half of 56 that I spent living in villages in India. At that time, commercial air travel was still largely prop planes. We were beginning to get some of the early jet planes. So it was relatively slow, and as air travel goes today, it was slow, and they had to make frequent stops because the prop planes burned quite a bit of fuel, so they couldn't. I don't think we even had transatlantic flights yet. They had to stop in Newfoundland or Greenland or someplace in between to fuel. You couldn't just fly from New York to London back then. But to get to India, it was decided we would go by boat, and we left New York on August 17th, 1956, and arrived in Bombay, I think it was 22 days later. We crossed the Atlantic, went through the Straits of Gibraltar, stopped in Naples, and then stopped in Palermo, Sicily, and took on some fresh food and water, and then went on to Naples. Then in Naples, we changed ships after a four-day layover, and we had been on a Greek ship, the Queen Frederica, and then from Naples to Bombay, we were on an Italian ship, the Victoria. It, incidentally, was the sister ship of the Andre Doria, the ship that collided off the coast of Massachusetts, a Swedish freighter or something, and I think at least one of them sunk as a result of that. So anyhow, we went through the the Eastern Mediterranean, the Suez Canal, and then across the Persian Gulf and down the coast. We stopped in Karachi and then stopped in Bombay, which is where our group left ship.
Well, I'm old enough to remember ocean liners. When I was a kid, we went from New York to Norway on the Oslo Fjord.
Really?
It took us about a five-day trip. You know, it was really something, yes. Food was great.
the food is always exceptional on those ships. I think the management policy on these shipping lines is if people are going to be confined to a small place, they have to have, you know, something that stands out, and so they really go out of the way to produce some great meals.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about India. That, you know, like, I guess if you hadn't gone to India, you might still be growing tomatoes in New Jersey or something.
Yeah. As a youngster, I read a lot. I read biographies and history, and I also read some travel books, like books by Richard Halliburton, in which he did all sorts of interesting things, you know, trekking across deserts, and he swam the Panama Canal, and he was charged at the going freight rate for ships. I think it cost him $1.27 or something.
Oh, really?
Like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that kind of thing interested me. And then there was a book by a woman, I can't think of her name right now, I Married Adventure, it was called, and her husband was sort of a doctor, missionary, and was assigned various places around the world. And she, Osa Johnson, I think was her name, and her book, I Married Adventure, was one of the early books I read on traveling internationally. So when the chance came for me in 1956 to go to India, I didn't require any prodding at all. And my brother agreed to take care of the tomato harvest that year, so that freed me up to do what was obviously one of the an experience that influenced how I thought about the future and how I thought about the world, and probably was the key experience that led me to, in 1958, question the idea I had, which was that I was going to be growing tomatoes the rest of my life. And after living in the villages in India, it just seemed to me that growing more tomatoes would not be that exciting or satisfying. I mean, in a sense, I'd already done that. And so that's what led me then to think about what I could do internationally, and I wanted to work on agriculture at the international level, so I joined the Foreign Agricultural Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I think that would have been 1959, became an agricultural analyst in the Asia branch of the Foreign Agricultural Service.
Well, you wrote about, I guess you persuaded Orville Freeman, who was a Secretary of Agriculture then, and also President Lyndon Johnson, to kind of rethink our food aid policy.
Yeah. I think this was 1965, The government of India was working on its new five-year plan, and they'd asked for someone from the states to someone who knew international agriculture to review the agricultural part of their five-year plan. So, Secretary of Agriculture Orville Freeman decided that I should be the one to go to India. So this would have been in October of 1965. And what happened when I arrived, I was going to be there for, I think, 3 weeks or something like that. But I noticed almost immediately on arriving, I began to pick up signs that all was not well with India's crop that year. The government had been saying that they expected to harvest 95 million tons of grain. But I met a guy from Exxon I met a guy from Esso, which is now Exxon Mobil, at a reception one evening, and you know, just talking, and I asked him, how's business? And he said, our business is really great. He said, we're selling a lot of fuel for pumps, for irrigation pumps. He said farmers are sort of pumping day and night trying to save their crops from the drought and the monsoon failure. And so I made a note of that because none of this had been coming from the reports from India that made their way to Washington. And then I had wanted to meet a guy in the embassy, was on the embassy staff, wanted to meet him while I started to talk about it. And I'd written ahead of time, some weeks ahead of time, and he said, I'd like to meet, but I'm a duck hunter, and I always take off October to go duck hunting up north, northern India. But when I got there, he was there, and I said, I thought you're going to be duck hunting. He said, well, I would be, but there's no water in the lake where I usually hunt. So I began picking up these bits and pieces, and while I was in India, as I do wherever I am, I tried to read three or four newspapers each morning, or at least go through them, kind of get a feel for what's happening. And I was noticing that in the Indian newspaper I was reading about reports of drought, you know, here and there, and I began pulling these stories, clipping them, and then I began to realize that this drought was not a local drought. I mean, India always has, you know, some drought and some flooding because of the nature of its monsoon climate, but in this case there seemed to be reports of droughts from many different parts of the country, and I began combining that with the lake being dry up north and the record sales of fuel for irrigation pumping, and I took things like that and converted it into an estimate of India's grain harvest that year. And though they had been projecting a harvest of 95 million tons, I didn't think they were even going to get 85 million tons. And if that were the case, there's going to be a huge shortfall in their harvest. And the only country that could supply grain on the scale they needed, and I estimate it would probably take about 12 million tons, the only country that could supply grain on that scale was the United States. And but to do it, one had to get moving quickly, because it takes time to get grain from elevators in Kansas, the wheat elevators in Kansas, to villages in India. And so I realized that time was really the key here. So I sent a cable to to Secretary Freeman, saying I've been looking at the crop situation here, and I think they're going to have a huge shortfall. Could be as much as 12 million tons, and we need to get moving quickly, because if we wait too long, we just won't be able to get enough grain in time. So he actually just sent that cable to LBJ just as I'd written it, and so then LBJ began to think about it as well. So we ended up launching the largest food relief effort in the history, and had to do a lot of interesting things to get the grain in, because it's one thing to get the grain out of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and what we did here, Secretary Freeman took charge of that, was to hire trains to go from Kansas to the port cities of Galveston or New Orleans, and then instead of them waiting for freight to carry back inland, just turn them around empty and let them go nonstop back to Kansas, load up again, and get down to the port. So we got that going on this end, and we were actually loading two ships a day with wheat for India. But on the other end, India didn't have the port capacity to move that much grain through its ports. But there were in the USDA some guys who'd been in the Army Quartermaster Corps in World War II who were really expert in, you know, how to get something from here to there in a hurry. So what they did was to lease the largest supertanker afloat at the time, which was the Manhattan. And I think it was an Exxon oil tanker. So that they leased that, cleaned it up, and anchored it in the Bay of Bengal and used it as a port. So U.S. ships coming with grain would unload on one side on the ship, and on the other side would be small boats that could make their way up the Ganges and its tributaries to get to the interior of India. And that's how we ended up moving this record amount of grain from from the southern Great Plains of the U.S. to hundreds of thousands of villages in India.
Well, we are talking with Lester Brown, who is the founder of the World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute. He will be speaking next Tuesday at the World Affairs Council here in Portland. And let's talk about the World Watch Institute. How did that get started?
Well, I realized in the early 70s, when I was working with the Overseas Development Council, doing research on international food and agricultural and development issues, I realized that environmental trends were emerging and were beginning to get some of the early hints that we might be facing climate change at some point, and we're faced with other environmental issues, more traditional ones like deforestation, soil erosion, and so forth. And I could begin to see how environmental trends could begin to shape our economic future. And while there were research institutes in fields like economics and international affairs and so forth who would have a unit working on environmental issues, it seemed to me that we needed far more than just a few people here and there, and that it was important enough that we ought to have an institute focusing exclusively on global environmental issues, broadly defined. So I approached the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and asked, and they were actually doing long-distance planning as the Rockefeller Brothers Fund management shifted from the brothers' generation to the cousins' generation. And I was somewhat involved in that. And one of the things I had suggested was the idea of doing a sort of a report card for the Earth and publish it each year and kind of take a look at the Earth's vital signs and give it a physical, if you will. And they liked the idea. After going through all the options they'd been thinking, and they came to me and asked if I was at the World Watch Institute at the time, if I would be willing to do that. And I wasn't too eager to do it, because doing an annual ties up a lot of resources, and we weren't a terribly large organization, so I declined. And then I declined a second time when they came, and then they came again, and so that time they convinced me to go ahead and and do what I had suggested someone ought to do. So that's how the State of the World reports were born. The first one was produced in 1974, and within a few years, the first printing in English was up to 100,000 copies, and it's been published in close to 30 languages around the world, mm-hmm. and became sort of the principal reference in the environmental area, and governments used it, for example, because there was no UN environment report at the time. There is now, but it didn't get started until, I don't know, 1995 or something like that. So this environmental report that we produced at the World Watch Institute became the basic reference that was used by governments and UN agencies and business corporations, obviously, as well as NGOs around the world.
Well, and then you moved on to the Earth Policy Institute, and how did that differ from World Watch?
Well, it's much smaller at World Watch. I had to do a lot of fundraising as president. We didn't hire a fundraising person. I just sort of did it myself. But it was a large research organization, and it did take time to raise funds and to manage. And then when I had a chance to start the Earth Policy Institute, which is only a fraction the size of the World Watch Institute, then I knew I'd be able to spend most of my time in research and writing, and much less on fundraising and management. So that's why I've been at the Earth Policy Institute now for 13 years.
Mm-hmm. And then
it's worked very well for
mm-hmm.
me.
Well, that sort of leads us to Plan B. I'd really like to talk about Plan B. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the things that became clear early on in Earth Policy was that while we were good at defining the problems and seeing the risks associated with continuing as business as usual, we didn't have an alternative. We didn't have a Plan B. We only had business as usual, which I called Plan A. What I realized was that we need to look at we knew that the existing economic system was not sustainable. And so then the question is, what would an economy look like that would be sustainable? And that's when we came up with Plan B. It describes the sorts of things we need to do in order to create a sustainable future. And I did, I think, four editions of Plan B, elaborating in more detail and sort of updating with each one. But the sort of the key things we need to do, one, we have to get the brakes on population growth. We're having trouble adequately feeding the 7 billion people we have today, much less the 9 billion we'll have in a few decades if we don't get the brakes on population growth. The second thing we need to do is cut carbon emissions, cut CO2 emissions, and cut them fast, because it's carbon emissions that are driving climate change and leading to global warming. And the key to stabilizing the Earth's climate is restructuring the energy economy, moving from an economy that's powered largely by fossil fuels to one that's powered largely by wind and solar energy. So we sort of know what we need to do. And the question is, what does that translate into in terms of plans and policies and so forth?
Well, you mentioned in your book, I wanted to ask you, has Tom Friedman ever read Plan B? because you mentioned him at a panel discussion with James Cameron and somebody else that that Plan B was mentioned, and Tom Frieden was there. And of course, he writes all these books about all sorts of wonderful stuff going on in the world. And does he know about Plan B?
Oh, yeah. I know Tom well.
And, what did he say about it?
Well, he understands that we've got to make a lot of changes, and he usually takes them on one at a time. Like, he'll do a column on water, or he'll do a column on desertification, and, you know, as he sees it in the Middle East and the role it's playing there. So Tom is very much part of this of the same school, as is James Cameron, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk. You talk about the new geopolitics of food, and I guess that's going to be your topic when you're speaking Tuesday here. Can you describe that?
Well, during the most of the last half of the last century, the big problem in world agriculture was surpluses. And so in the United States, in addition to having huge stocks of grain, we also, throughout much of the last half of the last century, paid farmers not to produce on some of their land. And the way that worked was that the government provided a support price for wheat or corn or what have you, so much per bushel. But in order to be eligible for that support price, farmers would have to agree to reduce their planted acreage by, say, 15%. So we had this idled cropland in the 50s, 60s, 70s, up into the 80s. But then things began to tighten up, and by the time this century began, there was no longer any slack in the system. And then things began to gradually tighten in the food situation until in 2007 we had a poor harvest, a subpar harvest for the world as a whole, and food prices began to rise worldwide. And some countries were afraid of the political consequences of rising food prices, and two of them were grain exporters. So both Russia and Argentina restricted their grain exports in order to keep domestic food prices under control. But in restricting or banning their exports, they created panic in the world grain market, because importing countries had always assumed that they could rely on the world grain market, that they would have access to supplies. And then suddenly they realized that they could no longer count on that. And that's when the new geopolitics of food kicked in, and importing countries began looking for land in other parts of the world on which they could grow food for themselves. So this started with importing countries, but then as land and water resources tightened and people realized that land was actually a good investment because the land price index was going up about twice as fast as the Dow Jones Industrial Index. So we had this sort of land rush with initially governments of importing countries and then Wall Street investment firms, agribusiness companies, beginning to, I mean, even university endowments in investing in land in other countries. So this was the beginning, this was the first really solid evidence we had that the world had made the transition from an era dominated by surpluses to one that was going to be dominated by scarcity. And we have seen the world price of grain double over the last 6 or 7 years now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see even higher grain and food prices in the future.
Well, We are talking with Lester Brown, who is the founder of the World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute, and he will be here in Portland Tuesday night at the World Affairs Council speaking about what we're talking about now, the new geopolitics of food. Well, it seems to me that, you know, it's one thing to buy or lease land overseas, something completely different to hold on to it or get the produce if things go bad in that country.
It is, and what most people don't realize is how much infrastructure it takes to support modern agriculture. And people think, you know, you buy 100,000 acres of land or a 500,000 acres someplace, and you go in and you plow it up and you plant and you harvest. What they don't realize is that modern agriculture requires, first of all, energy systems. You have to have you have to have an electricity grid, for example. You need to run grain dryers. You need to have a place to store fuel. You have to have an understanding of local insect problems, some local crop diseases, and you have to be able to have the insecticides or fungicides or whatever on hand to deal with those. You have to have a lot of knowledge that doesn't exist in these countries where land is being acquired. I remember reading about the Chinese acquiring land in West Africa, and they planted rice, and they tried different varieties of rice from China, and not one of them worked on these soils and in the growing conditions in tropical Africa. I mention that because it takes a lot of knowledge, and it takes a very sophisticated support system to for modern agriculture to be able to function. You have to have equipment maintenance, for example. You not only have to have the equipment, but you have to have a system of, you know, spare parts and trained mechanics and so forth to keep things going. And we take those for granted in the United States because you have a problem, you just go to your local farm equipment dealer, you know, and get the parts you need or get a mechanic from there to come out and fix your tractor or your combine or whatever it is. But without that infrastructure, you're really up the creek without a paddle, and it takes a while to build that infrastructure. You don't just snap your fingers and suddenly it's there. That's why we've not seen very much food produced yet on these land acquisitions, though some of them are huge acquisitions.
Well, I think we're in a period now that cheap oil has gone for good. Oil is getting more and more expensive, and what kind of agriculture can survive? And would you have in that kind of a period? You know, now we have, they say, one farmer in America can feed 100 people, but if that's with a lot of oil and machinery and everything else. But maybe in the future, you need a lot more people on the land in one way or the other.
Well, we sort of assume that we're always going to have oil because that's the foundation for modern agriculture in many ways. But we're not going to, and we're going to have to think about how we farm without oil, and can we electrify farm systems, from other sources like wind power and solar energy and so forth. So it's we're looking at a very different future, and there's a tendency by those who do agricultural projections to simply extrapolate the recent historical trends in order to see what the future will lack. And that technique has worked pretty well for a half century, but I don't think the future is going to be, our future now is going to be a simple extrapolation of the future, of the past. And so we have to think about that. We have to think about water, for example. Mm-hmm. There's very little spare water in the world today. Everywhere that we have irrigation, it used to be all the irrigation came from dams and rivers, but now in many places in the world, it's mostly underground water. And what we're experiencing, whether it's the North China Plain or the Western Plains of the U.S., is the depletion of aquifers. And as we overpump, and we're doing a lot of it in the world today, as we overpump, water tables fall, aquifers are depleted, and wells go dry. India, for example, has farmers there have bought 26 million irrigation pumps, and they are expanding grain production at a rather robust rate, but they're doing it by overpumping, and before long, these wells, well, they've already started going dry in some places, but water tables are falling in every state in India, and they're going to have to come to terms with this in the not-too-distant future, because you can overpump in the short run, but not in the long run. And the World Bank points out that in India, at least 160 million people are being fed with grain produced by overpumping.
Well, of course, those pumps use a lot of diesel, too. I remember reading not too long ago that the Taj Mahal in India, that they have 50,000 diesel pumps on hand in case power goes out. That's kind of amazed me to read about that.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that I've been to the Taj Mahal, and it just doesn't seem quite that big. They had 50,000...
That's what I read.
50,000 barrels, did you say?
No, 50,000 diesel pumps.
Diesel pumps.
On hand, you know, to run all their electricity in case there was a power shortage.
That surprises me a bit. I wonder if it's the town where it's located that has that many on hand. That's a lot.
Because it seems to me these power shortages are all over. It seems last year I interviewed Ahmed Rashid, who's a sort of a Pakistani journalist and historian, and he lives in Lahore, which is one of the better-off towns in Pakistan, and I just sort of asked him, I said, what's the power situation there? He said, oh, they have electricity about 3 hours a day.
Yeah, it's sad. Pakistan has problems with getting enough electricity, but they have a lot of other problems too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear whether the current government is capable of dealing with these problems, particularly with the Taliban in the background, sabotaging and actually gaining control of part of the country now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, here in Portland, we had a woman, she passed away recently. Her name was Gail Ochterman, and she was an environmental attorney, did a lot of work for the state. And she gave a speech at the City Club, and I remember hearing her, she said that one thing that keeps her awake at night was thinking of all these refugees coming up here from the Southwest, because the Southwest is really kind of drying up, and... the Hoover Dam, the water level there is sinking to the point where the intakes on the dam, at a certain level, they stop working. So you get no more electricity from Hoover Dam. And what happens then?
Right. Then we discover kerosene lamps and candles all over again. I can actually remember that. I learned to read by a kerosene lamp.
Uh-huh. Well, when I was a kid, we had a little summer farm in Vermont, and for a few years, we didn't have electricity. We had a kerosene stove.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we had a little tank out in the back of the house, and a truck would come by and fill it up now and then. We actually had an ice box. They had an ice house down in Lincoln Center,
mm-hmm.
kept ice packed in sawdust all summer long, which really amazed me.
Every
few days, you get a big chunk of ice and put it in this ice box and keep our milk cold and stuff. And But yep. Then we got electricity, you get radio and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, it would just seem to me that agriculture would just be completely different in the near future. And I'm trying to puzzle it out myself.
It's surprising how little attention political leaders have given to this question. And I think it's partly because they hope that, you know, we won't have any serious problems on their term, and then it'll be someone else's problem to worry about. So they're not really paying nearly as much attention to it as they should. Another thing that's happening, I know we only have a few minutes left, but in probably 40%, probably 40% of the world's grain is now produced in countries where farmers appear to have hit the glass ceiling with grain yields. That is, once you've eliminated moisture constraints and nutrient constraints, then the remaining constraint on grain yields, the only remaining one, is photosynthesis itself. And once you're using that as efficiently as you can, there's no place to go to further expand production. And that's another thing that I don't think political leaders have realized, and indeed probably not that many scientists, because we've been increasing yields for, you know, more than a century now, a century and a half in Japan for rice yields. So everyone's sort of assuming, you know, they're going to just keep going up, but they're not. And in both Japan and China, rice yields are now plateauing. Japan's not increased its rice yields for the last 17 years.
Well, do we get into a kind of a maybe permaculture? Is that a avenue of the future?
Well, there are some things that we can do with permaculture. It turns out that a lot of the crops that we now produce and the way we produce them sort of maximizes production in the short run, but it can't last in the long run because it's so petroleum dependent, for example, and because the backlog of unused agricultural technology is shrinking pretty steadily now. In a country like Japan, for example, the rice farmers keep looking over the shoulders of the researchers at the research stations and hoping there's something new coming that will enable them to get rice yields going up again. But 17 years have passed since rice yields plateaued in Japan, and they have not increased at all. It's been flat as a pancake.
Well, do they switch to some other crop then?
They import more.
Mm.
And you can do that in the short run, but eventually there'll be so many countries importing that exporters won't be able to produce enough to supply them.
Well, one final thing I read was that that Egypt sort of followed the World Bank's advice and sort of paved over the banks of the Nile for cities, and now they're no longer growing their own food. But I think we're at the end of our show. Anyway, I want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Lester Brown, who is the founder of the World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute, and he will be speaking here in Portland Tuesday night at the World Affairs Council. Thank you very much for being with us.
Earth, thank you. I've enjoyed the hour very much.
Well, thank you very much, and hope we can do it again.
Okay.
Well, stay tuned. This is Fight the Empire. Stay tuned for KBOO's glorious programming.
Good morning. It is a minute now before 10 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up in 15 minutes at 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, today we'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring a look at the Pan-African Solidarity Campaign regarding the International Criminal Court. The campaign says even though human rights violations and war crimes are happening around the world, the court only prosecutes cases against Africans. At 11 today on Between the Covers, Portland writer Rob Yardoumian discusses his debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water, and the accompanying music CD, Sing With Me, Brother, For We Have Sinned. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the topic is independent booksellers, with guest Michael Hicks of Black Rose Books and Phyllis Benton of Midnight Ramble Films, and host O.B. Hill of Reflections Mirror Image Books. That is all coming up this morning on KBOO. But first, hear Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our fall membership drive. It's still not too late to join. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today.